All right, it's time for us to begin tonight. We're continuing our study of the Samuels. So, of course, we know that 1 and 2 Samuel are there in the, if we broke up the Old Testament into sections, we have the first five sections of the first five books of the Bible, and we call that the Pentateuch or the Torah, written by Moses, the books of the law. And then you have, what's the next section if you're looking at your table of contents? Do you remember the next section? What do we call that? Books of history, exactly. The books of history. So we're in the books of history. And we talked about the book of 1 Samuel dealing with transition. The 1 Samuel, its main theme is transition. What were we transitioning to and from in 1 Samuel? What was the big change? Yes, so we're changing from judges to a king, from God to a king, as far as from a theocracy to a monarchy. And the people wanted it, despite better judgment, better counsel, the people wanted it. It's interesting that when Gideon was asked to be king back in Judges 8, he said, "Nor myself nor my sons will rule over you. Have a king. God is your king." Judges chapter 8. And so even back then they were trying to do this, but they were able to maintain this up until this point. So we talked about also something interesting about 1 Samuel. We don't know who the author is necessarily. We've attributed it to Samuel, but why didn't Samuel not write 2 Samuel or a large part of 1 Samuel? Any guesses? Because he's dead. It's hard to write a book when you're dead. I know people have tried. But it's hard to write a book when you're dead. And so we don't know exactly who wrote this book, but it's more likely that it was a composite. We have here in the notes in 1 Chronicles 29:29 that states that Samuel, Nathan, and Gad were all writers. They've all written books, and so it's probably a compilation of several people maybe. But from the details of the book, it was somebody close to the time of it actually happening. The date range, we're looking roughly at 110 BC to 970, so about 40 years there on the dates of the events that we took place in this book. And the main theme is David. So the main theme last time was transition, right? Another transition that we didn't mention in the 1 Samuel was there should have been a regime change, right? There should have been a regime change. From whom to whom? From Saul to David. That should have been the change. That should have happened. It did not. It was not a smooth transition. And we're going to see that in this, that unsmooth transition continues in 2 Samuel. Now something else about 1 and 2 Samuel, were they at one time of one book? Do you remember? If you're nodding your head, yes, you are correct. At one time, they were one book. And that's why when you get to the end of 1 Samuel and kind of transition into 2 Samuel, it's like, hey, these guys go together. It's because they were originally together. And when they went to codex form, they went to a different type of writing. And that's probably when they went from scroll to book. That's when they made that transition and broke these up, possibly. The Septuagint, the Greek writing of the Old Testament, has them divided into two. And so that's probably a later time. So 2 Samuel, where did we end off in 1 Samuel? Where do we leave off in the book of 1 Samuel? Death. What's that? The end of Saul and his sons, and they're buried under the tree, the shade tree. Right? And so that's where things leave off. Now, remember in all of that, when all that was happening, David had gone out with the Philistines against Israel, right? He had spent time, like a year and a half, with the Philistines. They had that city Ziklag, and they had gone out with the Philistines. And then the other Philistine lords were like, hey, why is this guy with you? Do you remember that? And what did the king that was with David, what did he say? He's legit, guys, right? He's totally cool. Like he's done everything I've asked him to do. That's the paraphrase version. But the other lords were saying what? Yeah, he's like totally for the other team. And you know, they even the Philistines even said Saul killed his thousands, David killed his tens of thousands. So even the Philistines knew that song, which probably wasn't a big hit for them, but they knew it, all right? They knew that song. So they knew David's reputation. They knew who he was. They weren't fooled. They weren't going to allow David to be there to attack them from behind the lines. And so they sent him back. And that's when David goes back. And what does he go back to? Do you remember? He goes back to his town and, hey, honey, I'm home. What happened? Actually, it was, hey, honeys, I'm home, because he had two wives. But what happened to the city? Yeah, they've been raided. Now, you back up a little bit more, and what had David been doing when he was spending that time with the Philistines? Just kind of chilling, watching Netflix. What had he been doing while he was raiding too, right? He was going out. He was saying he was raiding the Israelites, but in reality, he was raiding these guys in the southern Negev, okay? So what happened when David's gone, the people who he had been raiding come and raid him, right? That's just how it rolls back then. So you got to be careful with that kind of stuff. So they came there. They burned down his house, killed his dog, burned down his climbing tree, and took all of his family and everything away from him and left, right? Basically, destruction of their, and they come there and they mourn, almost stone David, and they go chasing after these guys. They find the Egyptian, they tell him where he is, and they destroy that, and they go back to Ziklag, okay? So that's what's been going on with David. Meanwhile, while that was going on, Saul's fighting this battle and losing epically, and him and his lineage, at least that with Jonathan, die on the hill in Gilboa, and David still knows nothing about the war, knows nothing about what happened. And so when we pick up in 2 Samuel chapter 1, we have this sort of meanwhile back at the ranch. David is, you know, in Ziklag, kind of how this kind of starts off, and this guy comes. All right, now I don't know if you've ever watched a movie before, but when you start a movie and there's this like guy that's all tore up and everything coming into a town, a dusty old town, to bring bad news. Have you seen a Western like that that starts like that? You know, the dusty old guy comes into town, bad news, the bad guys are coming. So that's how that's the scene that opens up in 2 Samuel. It says, "Now it came about after the death of Saul, when David had returned from the slaughter of the Amalekites, that David remained 2 days in Ziklag. On the third day, behold, a man came out of the camp of Saul with his clothes torn and dust on his head." Why would his clothes be torn and dust be on his head? What about mourning? What about that culture would tell us about why it was in this state? It was mourning, right? I mean, it wasn't that he like fell through a bramble patch or something like that on the way there. They would tear their clothes in mourning and dust and ashes and as an outward sign of the pain they felt in what was happening. And actually to this day, at a Jewish funeral, they will actually have clothes that they cut and a ribbon that they cut to still continue doing this practice of showing how long they mourn. But this is what's happening. And so this guy comes into the camp and then begins to tell them what happened with Saul, what took place. And they ask him, so where have you come from? And he said, I've escaped the camp of Israel. And David said, how did things go? Please tell me. David's a little bit earnest to know about what's going on, right? Maybe not so much for Saul. I mean, he respects Saul. But Jonathan, his friend, is involved in this. The future of Israel is involved in this. And so they're anxious to know what's going on. And he retells a story about how he happened to be on the hill when this took place. Now, as you read this story, what changed with this story? How did Saul die at the end of 1 Samuel? Huh? Suicide. He fell on his sword, right? He asked his armor bearer to kill him, and his armor bearer said, I can't do that. And so he fell on his own sword. How did this guy describe his death? What's that? Yeah, he was leaning on a spear when it came up to him. And what did he say?
Kill me.
Kill me, right? And this, who is a, we'll find out, is an Amalekite, who is a foreigner, says, what did he do?
He said he killed him.
We just had a lesson about opportunities, right? This guy seized an opportunity. I'm going to be the guy that kills Saul. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's good. He wasn't pulling out of this nosedive, all right? He was riding this straight into the ground. This was going nowhere. So I know, Dr. Kevorkian, we just took care of this, okay? So that's what he's saying in relationship to justifying what he's doing, okay? And so he says he brought the crown, he brought the bracelets, and what is David's response to this? We know that this guy's an Amalekite. He said, I'm an Amalekite. He's a father. He's an alien. He's not a Jew. And 11, what is David's response to that news? He tears his clothes. They mourn. Yes, sir.
Would the guy who tried to kill him, would he commit back to the martyr?
I'm sorry? Not in this case, no. There wasn't dying for any specific cause. No. But in this case, David mourns, and all his men mourn with him, and they mourn and wept and fasted. And then they come around to getting back to this Amalekite. Verse 13, David said to the young man who told him, where are you from? And he answered, I'm a son of an alien, an Amalekite. And David said, stretch out his hand. He said, how is it that you're not afraid to stretch out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? What had David said? Like when he had time to kill Saul, he had opportunity. Even his own men said, look, God's delivered him into your hands. You know, strike him, strike your enemy down. What was David's response? I'm not going to kill God's anointed. I'm not going to be the one to kill God's anointed. And so David here, and this reminds me of, you know, here's David asking this question. And I think probably this young Amalekite realized that this is not a good situation. I'm just envisioning how David is asking this question, that, you know, he's giving off the airs, that it's probably not a good thing that you did this. How is it, right? How is it you were not afraid to stretch out your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? And David called one of his young men and says, go cut him down, and kills him. And because he had killed the Lord's anointed, he says, your blood is on your head, for your mouth has testified against you, saying, I have killed the Lord's anointed. Did he? Poor choice, right? He lied about what happened to capitalize on what he thought, assumed, would be David's response. And he did not know David's heart. He did not know how David had responded in times past about this. And it was a poor choice. He chose poorly. So in this case, so this is the death of Saul and how the news reaches to David. I forgot to mention just briefly an outline here, just breaking up the book itself. The first four chapters were dealing with David's reign over the southern part of Judah, because we're going to see very quickly that, there's some turmoil. There's not a smooth transition here of power. And then David's reign over all of Israel for the majority of this book. And in the end, David makes some poor choices, and there's some results, and we'll look at that at the end of Samuel. And so this first section we're dealing with here, just again, here's a map. You probably have this in your Bible. One of these is, yes, okay. So they're over here in Philistia, okay? And they're going to go up to Hebron right there in a minute. That's going to be a big word, a big place for us here shortly. And so that's going to be David's basically base camp for a while there in Hebron. So just so you know where that is and what will be happening. Jerusalem doesn't come into play until later on in the book as far as a key city. All right, so this first part, report of death of Saul and Jonathan, the first chapter. So David gets the news. They mourn. They kill the guy who supposedly, quote-unquote, killed Saul. And then David chanted a lament. What is a lament? What does it mean to lament? Sorrow, to express sorrow, right? We have a book of Lamentations, who was written by Jeremiah after the city, after, you know, taken into captivity. If you want a happy book to read, that is not the one. I would not go there. So there is that lament. And so we have here, then David chanted with this lament over Saul and Jonathan. I think it's interesting that he mentions Saul. Here's a guy. Would you lament somebody who had been trying to kill you for so long, who have caused you so much grief, so much turmoil? I was like, I may be doing an end zone dance, a happy dance, something like that, but I'm not going to lament the guy who's been doing that to me. But here's David, and he laments over Saul and Jonathan, his son. And he told them to teach, the sons of Judah the song of the bow. And actually, what do you have? What do you read there? What do you have in your text? Anybody have the King James Version there? The New American Standard, the American Standard have the song of the bow. What do you have in King James? I think it's the use of the bow, right? That actually isn't in there. And in the text, it just goes, teach them the bow. And so those phrases have been added in there to kind of give us an idea of what we're talking about. And so it's been assumed that, at least by the American Standard and the New American Standard, that we're talking about the name of this particular lament. And others have talked about the use of the bow, but it's neither here nor there. It's the bow. And behold, it was written in the book of Jashar. Now, if you looked into your Old Testament list of books, do you have Jashar in there? Is that listed in there? Have you heard of Jashar anywhere? It's only Jafar, no. It is mentioned in Joshua. In Joshua chapter 10, verse 13 is mentioned there. It is also called the Book of the Upright, or the book is the literal translation of that. It is an extra canonical, yeah, I think that's how you say it. A non-canonical book. So when we talk about canon, we're talking about the accepted books that are in the Bible, right? Those are the canon. And you can talk about canon with any type of sacred document. You have the canon for the Mormons, you have the canon for different groups, religious groups. So the canon for us in the Old Testament, they have non-canonical books like this one, the Book of Jafar. Just kidding. You got that in my head. So, but this book, Jashar, and there are actually 21 books that are mentioned in the Old Testament that we do not have copies of. 21 books that are named, briefly mentioned in the Old Testament that we don't have copies of. Are there books in the New Testament that we don't have copies of? There are. There's a letter to the... There's the way Paul writes to the Corinthians, there was another letter that the Corinthians received that we don't have a copy of. There was a letter to the Laodiceans that we don't have a copy of. And so what we're saying is there were other documents necessarily that we don't have copies of. There were 21 books that the people who were in that time who did have those books, who did have those copies, did not consider them to be inspired. Do you know why? Because we don't have them now. We don't have them now. The ones in the Old Testament, these 21 books, were not considered to be inspired. They were collections and stories and things of that nature. They were not considered to be inspired because we know that because we do not have copies of them now. If they were sacred documents, as faithful as the Jews were in copying those down and moving those documents through the years, they would have kept record of those documents. We don't have a copy of those.
And don't forget God.
Yes. Well, God played a part in that. But we don't have a copy of those as far as the transmission of those books. If you went online, like some of you are prone to do and want to be a Google historian, you will find a copy of the book of Jashar, but it is written from like the 1700s. There's actually four books that have that title that were written in the late period. So we do not have that book; does not exist. But it's interesting that these books are mentioned. I think it's interesting that these books are mentioned that we don't have copies of. And so this particular lament, the Lament of the Bow or the Song of the Bow, is written in there. As you read this, I'm sure some of you have started to read this as I rambled up here about this. What is David saying in this lament? How does he refer to Jonathan? How does he refer to this dynasty that has fallen? There's a phrase that repeats several times, at least three times, a very famous phrase, or at least has been made famous. What do we say when, let's say Alabama is unseated by, let's just throw a name out there, Ohio, for example. What would people say, maybe? Oh, how the mighty have fallen. Yes, oh, how the mighty have fallen. That's repeated three times in this text. Oh, how the mighty have fallen. This dynasty has fallen, and it refers to the beauty of Israel and the fall. And so, verse 20, he talks about how the Philistines being involved, how he hopes that they're not involved in knowing about this. What did the Philistines do to the body of Saul? Do you remember? It went up on the wall, right? It was a trophy. It became a trophy. David did not want that. He lamented that. And it did happen. But he lamented that possibility. He died on the Mount of Gilboa, so he mentions that. He mentions what happened there and being a place of mourning. Saul, he says, verse 23, Saul and Jonathan, beloved and pleasant in their life, and in their death they were not parted. They respected one another. Remember what Jonathan said? Whatever I say, my dad listens to me. They were pretty tight, Jonathan and Saul. They were very close. They died together, and they were buried together. I think it's poetic that that was the case. It's mentioned here. They are mentioned as swifter as eagles and stronger than lions. Weep over them, the daughters, who all the things that they had done for him. Again, verse 25, the mighty have fallen in the midst of battle. He says in verse 26, he mentions the closeness that he had with Jonathan. And again, we need to keep in mind that we don't need to read our 21st century construct of a relationship into this. But he loved very dearly Jonathan. And again, the mighty have fallen and the weapons of war perished. What weapons are mentioned here in this lament? The weapons of war, there were two that he mentions, the bow and the sword, right? Jonathan was an archer. We see that early in the relationship. The archer, the bow, is used to warn David. It was his custom to practice. So the boy that he used in that case, it was customary for him to be out practicing with the bow. And so the bow and the sword have perished. An interesting study, if you want to take some time in David's use of weapons in the Psalms. Go through and look how David uses the weapons of war in the Psalms, and how many times he uses them in relationship to God. God is my buckler. God is my shield. God is my bow. The sword of the Lord will deliver me. And so over and over again, he uses this construct of God being that armament for him. And so it's an interesting study to go through and look at how David uses, a man of war, would use these things in the Psalms in relationship to God and deliverance. And so he mentions them here in relationship to Jonathan and Saul. So chapter 2, as we finish that chapter, and we go, hopefully can finish chapter 2, David appointed king over Judah in the first 7 verses. So he got asked God, so what do you do? What do you do now? Right? What do you do now? You're David. Saul's dead. You've been waiting for this day for a long time. It's now your time to kind of go up and take over and the kingship, as you've been anointed for that particular purpose, chosen for that purpose. And at the very beginning of this text, he consults God. Where do I go? What do I need to do right now? Do I go up to Israel? And God said, yes. And he says, where shall I go up? And he says, go to Hebron. So they go up to Hebron, as we mentioned, into the southern part. And they go up with his family, him and all his men. And there in verse 4, the men of Judah came there, anointed David king over the house of Judah. And they told David, saying, it was the men of Jabesh-Gilead who buried Saul. And so he thanks them for that service, for burying Jonathan and Saul, and ask for them, the Lord's goodness on them. And in verse 7, he says, now therefore, let your hands be strong and be valiant, for Saul, your Lord, is dead. And also the house of Judah has anointed me king over them. So he establishes his kingship in southern Judah. That's what happens. Now, with a power vacuum, what happens? Somebody's got to fill that void, right? So the king, Saul, is dead. And what normally happens when a king dies? There's mourning, and then the sun comes up, right? The sun comes into take over. So we talk about the dynasty rule, dynasty transition. Now, it is apparent that the men in Judah either A, understand that David was anointed for this position, that David was chosen. Also, it could be that the people in Judah were still kind of in this construct that we pick the man who God is with. It was evident that God was with David. Everybody knew God was with David. And much like with the judges, they would have the judge come up, and it was evident who was going to be the judge because God was with that person. And so Judah anoints David as king. But Abner, who was a cousin of Saul, says that, you know, we need to take one of Saul's children. And so Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, had taken Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim, and he made him king over Gilead and over Asherites and over Jezreel, over Ephraim, over Benjamin, over all the Israel. And Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he became king over Israel, and he was king for 2 years. And the house of Judah, however, followed David, and the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. Why the time difference? Possibly, and we'll talk more about that later when we talk about transition to Jerusalem and stuff. But so here is the stage for confrontation. Again, David's a nice guy, right? Everybody loves David. But nothing goes smoothly for him, really, in transitioning. What should have been a smooth transition is not a smooth transition. Then we have this weird story with Abner and Joab. Abner is the commander of Saul's army, now the commander of Ishbosheth's army. Right? Joab is sort of the commander of David's army. And they have this confrontation, in beginning of verse 12. Now Abner, the son of Ner, went out from Maam to Gibeon, the servants of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and Joab, the son of Zerah, the servants of David, went out and met them by the pool of Gibeon. And they sat down, one on one side of one of the pool, and the other on the other side of the pool. And Abner said to Joab, "Now let the young men arise and hold a contest before us." And Joab said, "Let them arise." And so they arose and went over by count, 12 for Benjamin and Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 for the sons of servants of David. Each one of them seized his opponent by the head and thrust his sword in the opponent's side, and so they fell down together. Doesn't sound like a fun competition, right? Not one that So basically what this imagery is, you have these pairs coming up, and they grab each other by the head, like when you're in, and so they have the sword. And we're not talking about long swords. We're not talking about Romance period swords. We're not talking about those kind of long. We're talking about like a short sword. And they're doing this, and they just do this. You know, if you miss, I don't know what the competitive nature is in that. We don't know much about. I tried to do some research on death competition. I have no idea. How do you Google that even? No real research there for that. This was the nature of the competition. And then they get into a conflict. And this conflict, the servants of David begin to fight the servants of Ishbosheth and begin to chase them down. Interestingly, that place was given a name. And the translation of that name was a place of sharp swords. Was what that place was called after that. It got a cool name. But again, to us, in our context, we have no frame of reference for that type of competition. It doesn't seem like it was a contest. But however it was. And so it mentions, again, continuing with this kind of three sons of Zerah were the Joab and Abishai and Ashael. And Ashael was swift-footed as one of the gazelles. And they begin to chase after Abner. Have you seen a gazelle, like a deer? You know, they're crazy fast, right? That was the fastest thing they had in that area to relate to. And so he's chasing after Abner. If you're reading in that text, what's Abner telling him? So they're running. Okay, as you're reading this text, they're running, okay? And Ishael's chasing him, right? And Abner says, hey, go get the slower guys and go ahead and kill them and take their stuff. Quit chasing me. I'm going to kill you if you keep chasing me. And he doesn't even respond. He just keeps chasing him, right? And he tells him, why am I going to kill you? Don't chase me. I'm going to kill you. How does he end up dying? Abner ends up killing him. What does the text say? How did Abner kill this man that was chasing him? The butt of a spear. If you had to choose, okay, throwing this out there, you probably never will have to choose this. But if you had to choose which end of the spear you were going to take, which end would you rather choose? I would probably want the sharp end, right? But I'm going to hurt a lot less, much like digging your heart out with a spoon, because it hurts more, okay? So in this situation, the dull end of the spear goes through him. And not just like into him and it kills him. It says it goes out the back. It gives us detail, all right? So this was like finish him, Mortal Kombat move in this situation. We don't know why this information is given to us, but we're given that Abner tells him, stop chasing me, I'm going to kill you, and he kills him. Okay, maybe it was a discretion. He should have gone after some of the other soldiers instead of chasing him. We don't know exactly why this is given this information. But they turn back. What is important to note is the response to this. And verse 24, but Joab and Abishai pursued Abner, and when the sun was going down, they came to the hill of Ammah, which is in the front of Gia, by the way of the wilderness of Gibeon. The sons of Benjamin gathered together behind Abner and became a band, and they stood on the top of a certain hill. And Abner called to Joab and said, shall the sword devour forever? That's a poetic way of saying what? Are we going to keep doing this, right? Very poetic way of saying, are we going to keep doing this? Are we going to keep killing each other? Because who are they killing? Are they killing some foreign enemy? They're killing each other. Are we going to keep doing this? And so he says, do you not know that it will be a bitter in the end? How long will you refrain from telling the people to turn back from following their brothers? And so that's the point that Abner's trying to make. And Joab says, as God lives, if you had not spoken, surely then the people would have gone away in the morning, each one from the following his brother. So Joab blew the trumpet. And all the people halted and pursued Israel no longer, nor did they continue to fight anymore. Abner and his men went through the Arabah that night and crossed over Jordan. And Joab returned from following Abner. And when they had gathered all the people together, 19 of David's servants, besides Ashiel, were missing. But the servants of David had struck down many of Benjamin and Abner's men, so that 360 men died. And they took up Ashiel and buried him. Okay, so once we give the final count, the tally mark, which side won. And so David's side lost 20, and the other team lost 360. And so they were really, really putting hurting on them. But the point is, why would they continue? You know that it's just going to hurt. And that's what Abner's trying to say. This is just going to be bitter in the end. It's not going to turn out well if we keep fighting against each other. That's a call for unity, a call for understanding. I think we can understand that in relationship to relationships. Why would we keep fighting against each other? We try to find peace as much as possible because it's only going to be bitter in the end if we do not. Yes. And that's a very good point. Abner, say, let's look back at this. Abner started it, lost 360 men, and now saying, hey, let's stop. I don't want to do this anymore. Yeah, it could be. You're exactly right. It may not be a genuine, for the glory of Israel kind of request, maybe out of self-preservation, that we don't keep playing this game. So they decide it's a good thing to stop. And it was a good thing. They did need to stop. And even Joash says, you know, even if you weren't going to say anything, we were going to stop tomorrow morning. So any other questions or comments before we close up? We're going to have more time as we go through this book. We had some of our classes taken up last quarter or last 10 weeks, so we had to like hurry up and get through chapters. We're going to be able to take some time and go through this more in a sensible fashion, hopefully this time. So thank you very much for your time, and thank you very much for your comments.